A socioeconomic reading of Matthew. Now today I thought I would do my thing by reporting to you a little bit on The House of Disciples, a new book by Michael H. Crosby, subtitled Church Economics and Justice in Matthew. It's a 1988 book. It's not the first one that Crosby has written. And of course, it's from Orbis, where most of the good new stuff comes from. How many of you have heard of it or read it? It presupposes the all the new debate and research on social economic context of the New Testament. It's related to Wayne Meek's book, The First Urban Christians, which I'm sure most of you have read, and to that whole development. John Gager, Tyson, there's big in the discussions in this book, there are sort of scholarly dust-ups about who is right when they talk about the household structures, the churches in the home churches in the early Christian community. And Crosby has, I think, a fascinating chapter, and I'm going to report mainly on chapter 4, which he titles The Household Churches, Rightly Ordered Relationships and Resources. And the heart of what we're going to do today is also an excursion, as yesterday was, into some real alive texts. Crosby finds in the central part of Matthew, in chapter 17, and then in chapter 19, and you notice there's white material here, he finds two haustafel. Now, do you remember the haustafel? Well, that's a German word, haustafel, haustafel, translated into English, the tables of duties. And maybe we should just get warmed up by reading one of the Pauline haustafel. You'll recognize it as soon as we get to it. The there's a parallel haustafel, one in Colossians 18-25, and it's parallel in Ephesians 5:22-6:9. As soon as we start reading it, you'll recognize it. Will somebody do that? We'll just do the shorter one, Colossians 3:18-25. Got to get over here in the light so I can follow along. Colossians, what did I say?
3:18-25.
Okay, wait till I get it. Okay. Colossians 3:18-25. Okay, will somebody read it?
Wives, be subject to your husbands as it is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Children, obey your parents in everything, for that this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. Slaves, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever your tasks, work heartily as serving the Lord, and not men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. For the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he has done, and there is no partiality.
Now that's a set piece, a structure that's very common in the Greco-Roman world. Tables of duties. They have archaeological finds and so forth where these things were printed or engraved, like, you know, you used to have on the kitchen wall crossed stitching of a poem by Edgar Guest or of the Beatitudes or something. Now, what happened with these haustafel or official tables of duties was that the early Christian communities took them from the Greco-Roman world and Christianized them. The Christianization of this particular haustafel is more evident in the Ephesian form than it is in the Colossian form, which most scholars think is the more original. Remember, in the Ephesians form, it talks about wives, obey your husbands, but then husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for the church, which was a radical changing of the haustafel. Now, the scholarly discussion of the haustafel, or the haustafeln, I guess is the plural in German, revolved in part around the fact that they are patriarchal. It starts out, wives, be subject to your husbands. And I remember a couple times in my life where I was asked to do Bible studies in some of the early feminist meetings, and they always wanted us to jump in here because this is where the anti-feminists would take their stand. And actually, when you look deeply into either the Colossians table of duties or the Ephesians, you have an exploding of the form. Now, what Crosby does here, and we're going to work on that today after a little introduction and background, is to say that there is in Matthew 19:3 to 2016, a haustafel of a different sort. A haustafel of a different sort, a table of duties, which Crosby says was intended by Matthew as a guide to, and remember the title of his chapter, Rightly Ordered Relationships and Resources in these new Christian enclaves, which were the house churches. Now, that's a socioeconomic approach to the reading of Matthew that I simply was not taught at seminary in 1950 to 54. It's a new reading. A whole world of scholarship and reflection that leads us again to what I said the first night. It was always there, but we just didn't see it. Now, I'd like to, during this morning, invite you also to be a little bit critical along with me. Not everything that we see there today is probably really there. Some of the things that we see are, we bring to the text from our presuppositions and from the questions that we're asking. But I think my review of this chapter in Crosby's book, Chapter 4, The Household Churches, is an honest introduction to this kind of thinking about Matthew, to this kind of reading of the Gospel of Matthew, and it is an eye-opening challenge. Now, before we read and look at the haustafel, I want to give you some of the context that Crosby finds, along with other scholars, as the context for this, for the reading we will do of the haustafel. He says that the basic heart of the matter is caught up in Matthew 12, 46 to 50. Let's read that. Matthew 12, 46 to 50. Right here it is a tradition. Here on the chart it's Jesus' mother and brethren. Notice that wording. And it is not unique to Matthew. You find it in another form in Mark, in a somewhat sharper form in Mark, and you find it also in Luke. Will somebody read that, please? Whose turn is it to read? Are you sitting under lights that you can...
While he was still speaking to the people, behold, his mother and his brothers stood outside, asking to speak to him. But he replied to the man who told him, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" And stretching his hand toward his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother."
Okay. Now, is there any family member missing there?
No father.
Now, I have read that many, many times, and it never really hit me that there was no father there. We'll come back to this text. Crosby says it is the key to his whole construction here. Whoever does the will of God is my mother and brother. Crosby argues this is a constituting formula for a new kind of household. We know in Pauline Christianity that there were these churches in the house of Acts 12:12, it's Mary, the mother of Mark. You have Chloe's people mentioned in 1 Corinthians. You have Priscilla and Aquila, who obviously had a church in their house. And this social structure, also explored by Tyson for the itinerant preachers in the Jesus movement, they'd come to a house where there was a community. This structure was there. There's no question about it. And Crosby is arguing, and the whole school that he represents argues, that this was a rather formal social structure, new but not unrelated to earlier and contemporary social structures, and that it had clear economic implications. Now let me read some of the background material. It's a little bit technical because it comes from people like Melina and other folks who are doing socioeconomic studies in the Greco-Roman material Mediterranean world. Now, both at the time of Jesus and at the time of Matthew, the economic system was, Crosby reminds us, neither capitalist nor communist, but it was a traditional society in which cottage industry or home-based economic system prevailed. The household was the basic unit of economic of the economic system. Society was permanently structured into orders of people. Who were the categories? Freed persons, slaves, and then, according to this analysis, one of the great divisions among people, or categories into which people were thrown at that time, were Roman citizens or non-Roman citizens. And then there was a class structure which Crosby and all the scholarship he depends on would roughly analyze into about four strata. At the very top was the household of Caesar. Just below that, the nouveau riche, or the commercial bourgeois. And then, as touching on the Jesus movement and Palestine, the religious oligarchy of Jewish Palestine, named in our material the high priests. Now, the high priests were there as a socioeconomic upper class. In the Jesus context, they were no longer there in the same way in the Matthew context in the year 85. That was the top level. The next level were the sort of more lower classes, lesser official, local judges, official administrators, lesser tax collectors, stewards of absentee landlords. Does that ring a bell? You've got the unjust steward in one of Luke's unique parables, reflecting this level in the class structure of the time. Then sort of the third level down, below these were the rural proletariat of wandering day laborers. We're going to read Matthew 20 in a while. And of craftspeople, could it be fisher people and carpenters, if that's where Jesus fit in, and his followers? They were sort of third rung down, but not on the lowest. And then the lowest were the impoverished, marginalized peasants and city poor, who, if they survived, survived at absolute minimum standards. There's a quotation from Melina, which Crosby finds central to understanding the whole socioeconomic setup at the time of Jesus and of Matthew. And I've heard Melina lecture on this, heard this statistic before. Quotation, 98% of the people of the time unquestionably and unquestioningly accepted the authoritative domination of the 2% who directly or indirectly controlled the conditions of their lives. In other words, that would be the very upper level of the four levels we've outlined. On the very top, the household of Caesar and his high echelon administrators. Just below that, the entrepreneurs, the Roman business people that dealt in grain all over the Mediterranean basin, and it was a marvelous thing that that particular entrepreneurial class did for economic development. And then just below that, the high priests and their folks, the temple establishment in Palestine. Now, the total system at all levels worked by an informal principle, social contract, if you will, which Melina and the experts call reciprocity, which breaks down into two dominant principles, operational principles of the society: normative reciprocity and the right of subsistence. The thing that comes closest to it in my life of reading history and economics is, in a sense, the feudal system, but it was not really the feudal system, where the rulers kept the peasants or let's put it this way, the landlords kept the peasants safe and saw to it that they did not starve. That was sort of the subsistence level. In exchange, the peasants owed them work, taxes, grain, and everything. And this was the structure that worked, and it worked on every level. The landlord and the peasant, then the landlord and the people above them, and then the tax collectors giving the money back to the Roman structure. The reciprocity worked, and the right of subsistence worked, although subsistence for a man like Zacchaeus was not subsistence. He had a good bit of affluence. But this is the way, according to these social analysts, the whole thing worked. Now, there were three, this is the structure. Phenomenologically, according to Molina and Crosby, there were three levels at which reciprocity worked. General reciprocity or tight reciprocity, where you had a household and a landlord and wife, children, slaves, all those groups mentioned in the Pauline paternalistic Haustafel, where it really was work. The power people took care of their own folks. You have stories in the Greco-Roman world about how wonderfully well slaves lived in some well-ordered households, and you have stories outside the Christian tradition of masters, landowners who allowed their slaves over the years to work for their freedom and so forth. And you have a lot of that stuff talked about in Wayne Meeks's First Urban Christians, even. So that was one level of reciprocity. It worked, general tight reciprocity. Then there was what Molina and Crosby called balance, quid pro quo reciprocity, where it wasn't really tight and creative, it was kind of a standoff. And Crosby says that's the kind of reciprocal system in which the Christian communities, somewhat affluent in Antioch, probably lived and are presupposed in the writing of Matthew. We'll see more about later. And then there's the negative phenomenon of reciprocity, where it really didn't work. The upper didn't take care of the lower, or the lower didn't obey the upper. And that was where social disintegration took place. Now, how did you get located in this structure? You didn't have the upward and downward mobility that is the presupposition of our society. Molina and Crosby talk about sort of three functions: status, role, and act. Status placed you in this class structure, and status was something that came with the tradition. You inherited your position. If your father was a landowner, you were a landowner. It's like the tight, still operative caste system in India. That hasn't broken up yet. There have been some changes, and you know, we romanticize it and think that Gandhi released the untouchables. Now the government has laws and so forth which are supposed to give rights to the untouchables, but we've got an exchange scholar at Wartburg this year, Joseph Matthew from India, and he said the informal social momentum of the caste system is such that the untouchables are still recognizable as untouchables, and their place, their status, is pretty much determined by tradition and history. Now, what kept this whole structure together? Now we're getting into some of the radicalness, the iconoclasm that our friend Wachen said is there, sort of the hidden dynamite in Matthew and in the whole Christian movement, the Jesus movement. Religion, which was in the ancient world really inseparable from tradition and probably is here also, upheld all these structures, the sort of the informal status, role, act structures, and the more formalized class structures. All these structures were upheld by religion with its psychological structures of honor and shame. And there are a lot of fascinating studies on the point of the role of honor and shame in the ancient world. But the point that Molina and his whole crew, Crosby picking it up, makes is a powerful one, but only religion could undermine these structures. Now you know where we're going. You know where we're coming from. And you know, it's the thing that strikes me is that it is not different today in our contemporary world. When we were at the House of Studies in Denver, we felt very lucky that Stefania Kameta from Namibia would spend 3 days with us. I think he was coming back from a session here at Holden. And we asked him to lecture to us on the current situation in Namibia. And we'd been working on the Namibian stuff for 5, 6, 7 years and known Namibians. And I had expected in my innocence that he would talk some of the grisly, dramatic stories of how oppressive South Africa was and would stir people up. We had about 90 folks at the lecture. Warren Salveson, Kirk's dad, was one of them. And Kameta spent the whole evening lecturing us on apartheid as a theological issue. And he outlined for me, for the first time, which I later had corroborated when I read The Covenant, Missionaries of the Covenant, about South Africa, that the whole structure of apartheid is based on a theological premise. That the white people there are the chosen people, that they had their exodus or their trek into freedom into their and built in the wilderness their own society, which was theirs because God gave it to them. And Kameta that night said to us, apartheid will not crumble until its theological foundation is challenged. Well, already at that time, I think it was 85, the World Alliance of Presbyterian Churches, or the World Presbyterian Alliance, I don't get the name right ever, had elected Ellen Bosek as their international president and had declared apartheid a heresy. But it hadn't been bought at all in South Africa. And over the years, the church in South Africa has been forced at meetings and so forth. I was at one of the meetings that they had. It just happened to take place when I was teaching in Zimbabwe, at the University of Zimbabwe 2 years ago, where there was this incredible battle between the leaders of the Dutch Reformed Church and the daughter churches of which, one of which Bosak leads, to force the Dutch Reformed Church finally to say, we were wrong, apartheid is a heresy. They've now said it. They say it and they pull it back. They say it and they pull it back. But I think what is happening today in South Africa, the beginning of the disestablishment, only the beginning, but the beginning of the disestablishment of apartheid is directly related to what Kameda told us in 85 or 84. It will not begin to crumble until the theological foundation of this whole structure begins to crumble. And of course, the thing that's obvious as we look at Lent this year, and as I look at it, and I suspect some of you look at it the same way, in terms of the fact that our system doesn't work, but we don't know it. We in the church are still, by our silence and by the way we preach, undergirding our present system. And it will not change until the theological underpinnings of the system change. Now, that's sort of a half-sermonic thrust as we march through this, but I think we should keep that in mind as we read the Haustafel in a little while. According to Crosby, the urbanized setting for which Matthew wrote operated generally, as I've said, in terms of the middle level of successful reciprocity, sort of the quid pro quo. And according to Crosby's creative evaluation of it, there were in the Christian households, the new households in the Christian movement, still vestiges of patriarchal structures. There were in the ancient world other models besides the patriarchal structure that seems to be presupposed by the Haustafel or table of duties that we read from Colossians, and this was what they called voluntary societies, which had a more collegial structuring and could serve in part as a model for the new emerging Christian households. Let me at this point ask you to read another passage which touches on the missing figure in the heart of what Crosby calls the heart of the matter, Matthew 12, 46 to 50. Look at the discussion in Matthew 23, which ends up at Matthew 23, 9. Matthew 23, 9. Let me find it and get to the light so I can follow along. Why don't you just start? Well, start with 23:1. We've got some time. We don't have to go anyplace. Start with 23:1 and read that first paragraph.
And Jesus said to the crowds and to the disciples, "Teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must obey them and do everything they tell you. But do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach."
Now, when we were talking after your Bible study the other morning about the Jewishness of Jesus, the thing is, there is all kinds of affirmation of continuity with Judaism in Matthew, but it's a continuity with a flip, like Jesus. Both continuity, radical, and and more radical continuity, which becomes interestingly discontinuity. Okay, like the shattered Pentateuch in the structure here. Okay, keep going.
They tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Everything they do is done for people to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels of their prayer shawls long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces and to have people call them rabbi. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have only one master, and you are all brothers.
Now what is that? And you are all brothers. You read that and you say the structure of whatever new communities were emerging would have to be more collegial, more like the free associations than the patriarchal households. And the point that Crosby and the group who read this gospel from the socioeconomic point of view, the point they're making is that there was no social structure that didn't take the form of some sort of household. That was the basic social structure. Go ahead.
And do not call anyone on earth Father, for you have one Father, and he is in heaven. Nor are you to be called Teacher, for you have one Teacher, the Christ. The greatest among you will be your servant, for whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted.
Now, Matthew 23:9, about call no man your father on earth, for you have one Father who is in heaven, is unique to Matthew. And Crosby has in this chapter 4 that I'm reviewing for you a long, long discussion of the fact that Matthew mentions Father more than anybody else, but it is to make God the Father rather than to emphasize the patriarchal structure in the earthly household. That had to be put down before we moved into the reading of the house tafel. I think we will jump right into the house tafel now. It looks like it's about 8:58, so we maybe have to hurry a bit. According to Crosby, this particular house tafel that we find in Matthew 19:3-20:16 is the second one that you find in Matthew, and it is modeled not on the kind of house tafel we saw in Colossians and Ephesians, but on another model that goes sort of way back to even Aristotle, the first part of which talked about the right ordering of relationships, and the second part of which would talk in the household, the second part of which would talk about how you get income for the household. He says the switch here is that the first part talks about the right ordering of relationships, and the second part talks about the right ordering of limited resources. Limited resources. Now, the four sections that we're going to read of the house tafel, and we'll look at them by sections. The first one is Matthew 19:3-12. Dealing with divorce. The next one is Matthew 19:13-15, dealing with the place of children. The last one is Matthew 19:16-30, which deals with the rich young man, and then generally with riches and reward. And then Matthew 20:1-16, the laborers in the vineyard, which is unique to Matthew, and which is one, it's totally white here on the chart, which is one of the interpretive mountain peaks in the whole landscape of the gospel according to Matthew. So will somebody read then the first section of this four-section house tafel, table of duties, household code, 19:3-12. See, I have not, as I said, I've not taught Matthew formally at the seminary ever before, but I've done Bible studies and so forth. I have never ever considered this section a house tafel. That's absolutely new to me. And so I want to operate with something of a critical attitude towards it. At the same time, once, you know, the old principle, it was always there, we just didn't see it. Well, somebody, whose turn is it to read? I am.
And Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? He answered, have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. So they are no longer two, but one. But therefore God is joined together, let no man put asunder. They said to him, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? And he said to them, for your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for unchastity, and marries another, commits adultery. The disciples said to him, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it is not expedient to marry. But he said to them, not all men can receive this precept, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been sold from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to receive this, let him receive it.
Okay. Now, the way I have understood this passage in the past has always been, well, Jesus, for moral reasons, was tightening up the tradition on divorce. Right? And so you discussed this in terms of whether the Roman Catholics were right or wrong on divorce. And you had a whole discussion that centered around this question. The next paragraph, the one about being a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom, that was almost hard to, you didn't know what kind of a background that would have, and it had to do with priestly celibacy or not, and you would go back and forth. The context in which that thing was discussed sort of gave it either too much current relevancy or sort of irrelevance. I mean, I could never get really heated up about that paragraph on celibacy. Crosby comes in and reminds us that if you read this thing out of the socioeconomic context into which it was very likely placed, you have different meanings emerging. At the time of Jesus, and I think at the time of Matthew, the male, both under Jewish and under Roman law, while I'm not an expert on those and I've heard some discussions about them, had the right to grant the woman a bill of divorcement if he wasn't pleased. That meant, economically, she had no support. Crosby argues that Jesus' concern was not just for morality, but for economics in the household. You don't cut a person loose economically from the support system. You do not do that in the new emerging Christian households. I remember reading Jeremias a number of years ago in the first big book that he wrote, Jerusalem at the time of Jesus, him making that same point, that Jesus tightening up the divorce situation was for the economic benefit of the women. Now the section on celibacy, which although it doesn't show up quite on the chart, 19:10-12, is unique to Matthew. And Crosby argues, and it makes the passage more meaningful at least, whether he's right or wrong, it illumines the passage. He said, in the new emerging voluntary Christian households, there was indeed a shortage of goods. They were poor. And some people who were given the gift would voluntarily choose celibacy so that new mouths to feed would not be added to the household. Now that makes more sense in, from one point of view of this whole discussion about eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom, because it doesn't quite fit historically that somehow, in particularly in the Jewish tradition, that virginity is a morally more pleasing to God situation than marriage, because that's not in the Jewish tradition. There may be suggestions of that in the Greco-Roman world, but certainly not in the Jewish tradition. So from this point of view, to interpret that paragraph 19:10-12 in terms of the economic necessity of the emerging Christian household makes more sense than the old moralistic interpretation.
Does it say anything about a woman divorcing a man?
No, not here. I don't think the women had a right to divorce men in the Jewish tradition at that time. Let's go on to the next one, the section on children, Matthew 19:13-15. Whose turn is it?
Then the children were right laying his hands on them and prayed. The disciples rebuked the people, but Jesus said, let the children come to me and do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of heaven. And he laid his hands on them and went away.
Okay, the point that can be stressed again here is that even as women had precious few rights in the Judaism of Jesus' time, a woman was the property of her father legally, and the whole dowry system was an interesting and intricate thing, so daughters could become an economic almost investment for the father. Children generally had no rights, and in terms of the shifting of the status structure, which helped the whole social structure maintain itself, this is a very radical, non-sentimental passage. You know, we in the early Sunday school materials, we see Jesus, you know, with a whole bunch of kids, and isn't he a wonderful guy? Isn't Jesus wonderful? Jesus is the loving Jesus, loves little children. Crosby's reading of this passage said this was an economic status instruction for the new Christian community. Children have rights. Children have rights. A very radical statement of this sort of egalitarian, voluntary social organization of the household. Okay, let's go on to the next, which is also has new meaning if you go at it in terms of the at least plausible theory that all of this was intended for regulating the new emerging Christian household. That's 19, 16 to 30, two major paragraphs there, okay? Will somebody read that? I don't know whose turn it is. Somebody who's got some light.
And behold, one came up to him, saying, Teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life? And he said to them, Why do you ask me about what is good? One there is who is good. If you would enter life, keep the commandments. He said to him, Which? And Jesus said, You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and mother. And you shall love your neighbor as yourself.
Now, this is a flaw in Dear Crosby's argument. We are asked to honor our father in this passage, so that must be a little critical. Okay.
The young man said to him, All of these I have observed. What do I still lack? Jesus said to him, If you would be perfect, go, sell what you possess and give to the poor. And you will
now, this perfect word, do you remember that from your preaching? Isn't that Matthew 5, 58, 38? Be you perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. That's what you're asked to do in this mountain peak, which is a, maybe almost another house topple, almost another table of household duties, although I think it's broader. Be perfect even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Okay, go ahead.
Go sell what you possess and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come, follow me. When the young man heard this, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions.
Okay, let me just, before we go to that, read you a bit what Crosby says about this particular passage, and he puts it in the supposed context of the Christian household in the urban setting of Antioch. Quote from page 121 in Crosby's chapter 4. Reflecting perfection in the way that God is perfect, Matthew 5, it's 48, demanded that the young man, and here Crosby makes an interpretive leap, that is, the prosperous Matian house churches in Antioch. So he stands on the Matthew level for the prosperous Christian house churches in Antioch, and I'll read you another quote about that in a moment. Let me start over again. Reflecting perfection in the way God is perfect, 548, demanded that the young man, that is the prosperous Matian house churches, quote, go sell what you possess and give to the poor as the essential requirement for experiencing God's reign. In other words, if you're going to belong to the Jesus movement, the down payment on the new age, the fellowship of the new human beings, the new community, you must participate in the proper redistribution of goods. You must participate. That's the way Crosby interprets this thing. Not for some sort of moral reason, but for the survival and vitality of the new community. And don't you see echoes of that? Both in the stories told about the Jerusalem community in Luke, and in what happens in this tumultuous correspondence that Paul has with the community in Corinth. I mean, you don't have up front in Corinth quite the same call
for redistribution of wealth within each, within that community. Although you have this crazy symbolic text about the Lord's Supper or the love feast, where the rich ones in the community get drunk and the poor ones in the community sort of sit around wishing they'd brought more to the potluck. And so it's not the same structure that we have here, but it's a similar structure. And I guess I, now as I moil and toil on trying to learn something about the New Testament to teach it, I'm more and more convinced that there is something correct here. The early Christian communities in various places structured themselves as households. And they structured themselves with very clear economic implications. And you know, you can talk, we could spend a whole day talking about the collection of the Pauline communities, poor communities. Remember, Paul says you gave out of your poverty for the Jerusalem community, which also lived in poverty. But the interesting thing was, talking about, going back to the first night when we talked about how hard it is to cross ethnic and cultural, and I would say even more difficult today, economic and class lines, there were apparently in every early Christian community, both rich and poor, and they struggled with it. Okay, and the interesting thing too, when you talk about status, Jesus challenged to the young man who was obviously rich, and his riches came from his status. Jesus was calling for a change, for not upward mobility, but downward mobility, which didn't happen in their society, according to the reading of the structures of Greco-Roman and Jewish society in the Mediterranean world that I sort of sketched for you at the beginning. Okay, will you read the next section? How are we doing on time? Okay, we'll make it in and out.
We don't have anything scheduled after this.
Okay,
anyway, so we're
okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's read the next section of this particular section, which went from 16 to 30. Now, we read as far as 22, and the next one is kind of an application of that up to 30. Will somebody read that? I don't know whose turn it is. Will you do that?
And Jesus said to his disciples, "Truly I say to you, it will be hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven."
Okay. Now, that has new meaning when you talk about, when you think in terms of a concrete Christian household, a new arrangement, as being a doorway into living the new life, which is under God's rule. Okay?
Again, I tell you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. When the disciples heard this, they were greatly astonished, saying, "Who then can be saved?" But Jesus looked at them and said to them, "With men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible."
Okay, now does that have anything to say about the doability or non-doability of the Sermon on the Mount? We're going to be talking about that tonight. With God, with man, this is impossible. With human beings, this is impossible. But with God, all things are possible. Yes.
It strikes me that the disciples are kind of like a Greek chorus. Earlier when he was talking about divorce in verse 10 of 19, he just got through talking about divorce, and the disciples said, if this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it is better not to marry. The disciples are kind of there like saying, keep saying, gosh, we can't do this.
Yeah, exactly. Gosh, we can't do that. That's a good theme for the Greek chorus. Gosh, Work it into your liturgy. You write a liturgy on the Sermon on the Mount and have the people say, gosh, we can't do this, gosh, we can't do this, God. And then you have to come back. Oh, yes, with us, it is impossible. With God, everything is possible. See how it works. Okay, read, because there's a part we've got to get to that's very important here, okay?
Then Peter said in reply, lo, we have left everything and followed you. What then shall we have? Jesus said to them, truly I say to you, in the new world...
In what?
In the new world.
In the what?
The new world.
Okay, now that's the Greek word is palingenesia. In the new generation. This new thing that's happening. That's a Matthew thrust. And that has to do with the whole Wachin reading of what's going on here. The way we read yesterday, the deeper meaning of the genealogy. Something radically new is happening. And Matthew picks this thing up again on this. There's a marvelous discussion in Crosby about that word, palingenesia, which is translated here, the new world. Does anybody have any other translation here? For that?
Mine says, at the renewal of all things.
At the renewal of all things, yes. That's, okay. That's almost a better translation. Although, that particular word defies neat translation because it means more at the recapitulation kind of all things, or the regeneration. That would be a more literal palingenesia. At the regeneration of all things, okay?
Truly I say to you, in the new world, when the Son of Man shall sit on his glorious throne...
And remember, I didn't emphasize that quite as much as I should have yesterday. The way Vachin would do Son of Man is the human being, capital H, capital B. When the human being, the uniquely new human being, the Son of Mary by the Holy Spirit, okay, go ahead.
You who have followed me...
Well, start the sentence over so we get the...
Okay. Truly I say to you, in the new world, when the Son of Man shall sit on his glorious throne, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel.
And now, look at 20, back to the household, okay?
And everyone... who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or lands for my name's sake will receive a hundredfold and inherit eternal life. But many that are first will be last and the last first.
Many that are first will be last and last first. I have always interpreted that one sort of moralistically again. And Crosby says, no, that is talking about the reordering of relationships and the reordering of possessions in the new emerging households of the Christian movement. Now let's go on to the last section, which is absolutely stunning. It's absolutely stunning. Both, I think, every time you read it today, and certainly in terms of the structures that are presupposed in the Mediterranean world, stunning for that day. Whose turn is it to read? Somebody has got some light.
For the kingdom of heaven is like a householder. Went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. To them he said, you go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right I will give you. So they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. About the 11th hour, I lost my place, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, why do you stand here idle all day? And they said to him, because no one has hired us. He
said to them, "You go into the vineyard too." And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, "Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first."
Okay, the first shall be last, and the last first is the end of the previous section, or the frame for this section. Here you have the principle mentioned now, and then at the end of this section, it will be repeated again, okay?
And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the householder, saying, "The last worked only an hour, and you have made them equal to us, who have earned the burden of the day in the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity?" So the last will be first and the first last.
I said I've not taught Matthew formally at the seminary, but I've taught the parables course many times, and I have always taught this parable as though the point were that Matthew, in the context of his whole apparently legalistic, to use a loaded word, call in terms of his judgment on the basis of deeds, Matthew 25, 31 to 46, suddenly in the middle of it all says, "But remember," it's a theological point, "God is free to be gracious. God is free to be gracious." That's the way I've interpreted it, sort of into the theological stratosphere. I'm not going to back off on that necessarily, but Crosby says it must be interpreted with socio-economic seriousness. So I'm going to spend some time, if you've got the patience, to read what he says and then critique it. He says, "This parable shows the need for disciples to restructure not only their activities, but even their way of thinking about the just order of God's reign. A new order or a new level of reciprocity is demanded in the new Christian households, the recapitulation, the new world, the palingenesia, the new start." Quote, "The largesse of God, the generosity of God, the ultimate paradigmatic householder," this is a householder, "must be the ultimate criterion for economic relations on earth." Let me repeat that. "The largesse of God," remember I was always interpreting it spiritually, when I was teaching it to my students. God is free to be gracious. God is free to forgive. Without denying that, as we'll see in a moment, Crosby said, but the message for the Christian households in Antioch was that the largesse of God, the ultimate householder, must be the ultimate criterion for economic relations on earth. It's reflected, isn't it, in early Christian communism in Jerusalem? Each sort of according to his or her need. It's reflected there. It's not a perfect equation, but it's a reflection. So there must have been some sort of a thrust like this in the early Christian communities. The largesse of God must be the ultimate criterion for economic relations on earth, if these relations are to be perfect in the way that God is perfect. And I want to say that it seems to me our thinking has not changed at all in the church, or very little in the church, certainly not in the society, because I find when I read this parable sort of unvarnished, without screwing up my Christian machine, I find it just still kind of affronting. I don't like it. I simply don't like it. That wasn't like I've always kind of been mad at Jesus for saying that Mary, who just sat around, was better than Martha, who went and did the dishes and all. So that I can't get over that one either. It shows you how hard it is to get rid of your ways of thinking. Now, I want to read to you from 1:24 as Crosby even spells out at greater length the implications of this text, and then come down for a landing where he almost agrees with my earlier interpretation, which helps. While this parable primarily reveals a dimension of God's reign rather than strictly economic problems like unemployment and just wages, the experience of entering into God's house, into God's economics, and the word for economics is like the word for salvation, is predicated on human economics or house ordering in the New Age, the Polygenesia. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. That's from the Sermon on the Mount, 7:21. By having the householder pay the workers hired at the fifth round the same as those who bore the burden of the heat, Jesus shows that the ordering of the house of God's reign, and by implication, the houses, the households gathered as intentional Christians in Antioch, involves certain characteristics. And then he lists six. One, the land, the means of production, belongs to God. Two, God gives resources to every person who is open. Three, God resources all people equally, no matter how much or how hard they work. 2012. Four, the goal of resource sharing is not, quote, more to those who do more or less to those who do less, but justice. 2013. Five, God's generosity stands opposite to the niggardliness of humans. That's 2015. And six, in contrast to that mentality that seems to legitimate more for some, in God's reign, there is enough for everyone. And again, he says throughout the chapter, this has to be reflected concretely in the new voluntary households of the Christian movement. The parable not only reveals that everyone's needs will be met with a living wage when human justice reflects the justice of the divine householder, it reveals an entirely new kind of general reciprocity based on the model of God's gracious mercy toward all, especially toward the least ones, like children and like women. Now, that's worth discussing, and we're at the end of the hour, over the end of the hour, but I just want to pick up a couple other things. after he's done this intense reading of it, this economic reading of the of this parable, he does say, despite its economic overtones, this passage primarily reveals a message about the mercy and generosity of God that are given without distinctions and shine like the sun equally on the just and the unjust. That's a quotation from 5:45. And one other quotation before we quit. You said we had some time, so I'm taking permission. Crosby wants to see this whole house tafel that we've been reading, this table of family duties, as directly related to Christian households in Antioch. And let me just read this paragraph, which will sort of summarize for you where he's coming from in his socioeconomic reading of Matthew, particularly of this section of Matthew. Since first century society viewed an increase in one's wealth as quite possibly based on the exploitation of another, and because a large part of Matthew's community seems to have become powerful and prosperous, while the bottom levels remained dependent and poor, tensions were bound to be generated. Religious tensions about the law and the experience of God's presence were aggravated by the stratification of the surrounding society and its balanced and negative reciprocity forms, which gradually crept into the new Christian households. This opposed Jesus' vision of a community reflecting God's reign, and he has that hyphenated. Community hyphen reflecting hyphen God's hyphen reign. I think that's important. The reflecting word is important in his reading. It's not equaling or approximating, it's reflecting. We'll talk about that later. Thus, Matthew wrote to help the disciples in these new house churches return to Jesus' original vision of general reciprocity, especially toward the outsider, the poor, and the marginated. That's why the young man who was rich was supposed to go sell and give to the poor, not in a generalized way, you know, not going out and scattering on the streets to the hordes, but to these new symbolic communities, down payment on God's reign. I don't think we have to spend a lot of time spelling out the implications because they're right there in front of our faces. It'd be fun to discuss, and maybe we can do it informally. What does happen to new intentional communities? Ever since the Christian community began, the Christian movement began, people have tried these new alternative communities, whatever you want to call them. Most of them don't survive. Holden has survived, but the people have changed. Catholic orders have survived. The House of Studies that I worked in for a number of years had marvelous experience. It was its own form of funny little seminary alternative community. It didn't survive, although we did for a while. And I'm fascinated by the possibility that in our present situation new structures will arrive, which for our situation would approximate what Matthew was calling for in his situation, and which Jesus very likely called for in his situation. And I guess just to round it off, I'm wondering how many congregations that you pastor in the United States of America in the year of our Lord, 1990, move in the direction of approximating this vision. And you see, that the thing is, it's not that every congregation becomes sort of the ideal new Christian household, but it is that these congregations stand as sort of beacons that challenge, both by word and also by deed, the theological structure of our present society. Yes, sir.
Interesting to me, as I particular that Rich and Leanne's story, you know, he asks, what deed can I do? I mean, what, you know.
In terms of Matthew's approach, he's asking the right question.
Yeah, and Jesus' response to him is, what person can you become? And the answer is in the person that you can become, rather than the deed you can do.
But also Jesus challenges him to become a new person by doing a new thing, selling your goods and giving it to the poor. Isn't that right?
Well, he would have to sell his goods in order to become this new person.
Yeah. But you, and also, you do not become a new person without a new act. Yes, ma'am.
It's interesting to me, when you think about Christianity and the new way of living, it's interesting to me that the very best working example I've seen of the communal way of life is an Orthodox Jewish kibbutz kfaratz in Israel. A Jewish kibbutz.
To take a phrase from the parable, am I not free to do what I want with what is mine? I mean, let the example come where it comes.
I've got a problem here. The problem being that, you know, I can be a pretty good Christian until you go screwing around with my retirement program. that's confession, but that's also fact.
And there's probably not one of us here who doesn't have an insurance policy.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have a community, which is the insurance policy under this scheme.
Yes, under this scheme, the community is the insurance policy. And in communities that work, like some of the Catholic Sisters communities that I know well, both in Denver and in Dubuque, I think they have insurance policies on their buildings. But the young sisters coming up and doing the work that they do are the ones that are the old age security for the older sisters, although some of them I know, some of my friends, when the whole thing lurched and Vatican II came along and the whole structure sort of tilted, a number of people that I knew, nuns, left the parochial schools and upgraded their stuff and got into public school for a while. Not only because they got as much in 1 month for salary as they got before in the whole year, but also because they got in on some teacher's retirement and some of the other, even Social Security, that I don't think traditionally nuns were into. that's at the Sisters of St. Francis in Dubuque, because they had so few young nuns coming up that they just, that the old system was not working, where they would bring in the small amounts of cash that were necessary in addition to the rather substantial endowments to keep the thing going. I guess the point I'm just saying, we all have to live in sort of the reality, economic reality of our structure. I'm sorry.
Then from what Ivor said and what Al said, the question surely would be then, would we exchange, would we cash in our retirement policy for the opportunity of community, to experience community? Or do we want to keep it for ourselves?
Don't press me.
Maybe there's another principle. Maybe it says that you don't have to totally cash in, but that the church, the Christian responsibility is to give more than one receives. That is, I think that most serious-minded Christians are interested in a church that is doing that. I think the structure that tends to get enamored with perpetuating itself, like the examples of the TV ministries are so blatant.
Yeah.
They become corrupt. The reason that one of the reasons Luther broke away from the Catholic Church was because they were tending to want to amass wealth for itself. They had lost this economic principle of giving more away than taking in. And I think that's a very attractive part of Christianity.
And I think, we have evidence in the New Testament account that not everybody gave everything away. When you look at the percentages in Zacchaeus, in the Zacchaeus story, didn't he, I've lost the details now, but it wasn't everything. And it seems to me also that there was something economically a little bit naive about some of the arrangements in the Christian communism of Acts. Because if you live on the capital, you bring this stuff in, what Ananias and Sapphira didn't do and got zapped. If you live on the capital, after a while, you don't have an economic base. And even the most rabidly faith movements do an awful lot of fundraising. Mm-hmm. We depend on the Lord. We depend on the Lord. But boy, do they shout that from the hilltops, and do they ever say that to their constituents? So somehow, you got to live in this world. But the way you live in this world is, I think, what's talked about here. And I take great comfort from the diversities of these various attempts at living in the new household. There's no one formula for any time or any place. And when I look around and look for signs of hope, I see in even the attempt to try this, a great, great sign of hope. Great sign. I take strength.
You've got to be a little crazy to be a Christian, but the question is whether you don't have to have a certain amount of history and institutional development in order to have a framework for your craziness. If you don't have that, your craziness goes for naught.
Yep.
It's the institutionalization of
I have been fascinated in the last years by parastructures. I'll take the Roman Catholic orders. They are separate, but they also sort of build. In the Matins this morning, she said, "I don't know what a lean-to is."
Yeah.
A lean-to is what they tell us. The poor people used to build their houses right next to the cathedral. And so
At least one solid wall was there. And the lean-to went like this. And it seems to me that parastructures in the Christian community work. The sisters work. Some of the brothers' things work. Holden works. It's a parastructure, but it leans on the cathedral. It's a lean-to on the cathedral. Now, we've just finished about a decade of National Namibia Concerns. My wife is executive secretary of it, and it's a funny little outfit that just sort of started by sending out letters to people who were worried about what happened to Selma and Abisai Shayavali when they went back to Namibia, and then it sort of grew, and we've got 11,000 people on the mailing list now. And it goes from hand to mouth because it is a parastructure, but it leans against the cathedral. The name of the cathedral is the Lutheran Church. But you have to be somehow separate because the big cathedral doesn't move much. Mm-hmm. And the big church, you can't get it to go. Like a huge congregation is almost paralyzed because you've got to please people at this end and this end. And for social reasons, for economic reasons, you can't break the thing up. But a parastructure that depends, as Holden does, as National Ninja Concerns, other groups do, on the larger structure, but is also free, and also free to die. Your freedom is dearly bought. You're free to die as a parastructure. But for a while, a parastructure can be a very powerful image of this new thing, what Matthew calls for. Well,
I think one of the themes of one of our brothers, he's an orthodontist, and I can remember his saying it repeatedly that a major problem with the church is it doesn't know how to die.
Yeah, that's very important. I mean, structures come and go. The only thing permanent is change. Maybe that's what we've got to be aiming at in these new households. Okay.